This is Covenant Eyes Radio, helping you to live a life of integrity in a sex-saturated culture. For the past 30 years or so, there's been a growing movement among American evangelicals to give a thoughtful response to the problems associated with modern dating. This so-called modern courtship movement has become more and more prevalent in many different Christian communities throughout the Western world, but both from within this movement and from without, there have been criticisms of it. What is modern courtship? And is it the best social norm for singles to foster healthy relationships that lead to healthy marriages? For 7 years, Thomas Umstadt Jr. ran the website practicalcourtship.com, and this was to encourage a national conversation to help courtship work for more people. But after hearing story after story, he began to wonder if something was wrong with the model itself. He has recently released his first book, Courtship in Crisis: The Case for Traditional Dating. And today we begin our conversation with him in this special three-part program. Thomas talks with us today about what the marks of modern courtship are and some of the underlying problems he sees with the model. Now, in this book, you call out the idea that even though you had managed practicalcourtship.com for many years, you waited to hear more testimonies of courtship really working for your readers, but you just didn't see much fruit from the approach. So now I want to kind of back up a bit, especially for people who may be unfamiliar with what the whole debate is even about, or what perhaps even what the term courtship even means, because it sounds probably to many like an antiquated word or an unfamiliar word. So let's back up a bit. Once upon a time, you were someone who used to fit squarely within the so-called modern courtship movement, and you kind of tried to promote it and talk about it and make it work for more people. But when did this modern courtship, you weren't the one who invented this idea, when did this modern courtship movement really begin, and who were some of the key voices behind the beginning of that movement?
So modern courtship began arguably in the early 90s.
Okay.
And so folks like Douglas Wilson and Bill Gothard, Doug Phillips, were big proponents of it at the time. And it was a reaction to or rebellion against modern dating. And so kind of to really understand, I have a 4,000-year history of courtship in the in the book. I won't
bore
your
that.
Listeners with all of that. But I'm a big believer in, to understand how we got to where we are now, we have to understand kind of the history of how we got here. And so if you look back at, say, my grandparents' generation, when my grandmother was drinking, you know, soda with my grandfather, a typical church of 300 people would have had 5 weddings that year. A typical church of 300 people today would only have 2 weddings. Hmm. And depending on the church, half of those weddings would be for second marriages. And so we've seen this just collapse in the marriage rate. And we were hoping, I certainly was hoping, that courtship would help fix this. Because, you know, it's, as conservatives, as a Christian, I believe in the institution of marriage. And I wanted to boost it and encourage it. And it wasn't working. You know, of a typical youth group of 20 students, only 4 of them are going to be married by the time they turn 29. We have one generation that won't stay married, and we have another generation that won't get married. And if the institution of marriage is the foundation of society, and if that foundation collapses, the inevitable outcome is that society will collapse into chaos. You know, I don't want us to be like Rome that collapsed into chaos 1600 years ago. I don't want my grandchildren living in a dark age because we allowed, you know, the pillars of society to crumble. But anyway, going back to my grandmother's time, they had a completely different language for dating. In fact, the word dating in her day meant something completely different. And, when I started realizing when I was doing the practical courtship that courtship wasn't working, I finally went and talked to my grandmother, who had been against courtship from the 90s. She's like, I think that's a crazy idea. And I was like, well, what do you know? You're a public school. But I finally humbled myself and talked to her. And she explained that when she dated in junior high, which that at first was a shock to me, what we would call middle school today, her dad had one rule for her, one primary rule, and that was that she couldn't go out with the same guy twice in a row. They had a different language, which was just sounded crazy to me. I was just like, what planet did you live in where that was a good idea? But the word dating meant something different. They had a different term called going steady. And dating, what she was not allowed to do in junior high was to go steady. She was encouraged to date, go out with different guys, get to know them, get to know herself. But she was discouraged from going steady with any of those guys at first. And so by the time she was 18, she had gone out with, you know, a bunch of Bills and a bunch of Bobs, and she knew which Bob she wanted to marry, and they got married and stay married until he died 52 years later. So,
okay.
As did the rest of her generation. And they weren't super religious. They weren't like super Christians going on youth retreats and mission trips and Wednesday night services. You know, they were kind of cultural Christians, and yet they had this system that was working. And at the time when I asked her out, my grandfather had been passed away for many years at that point, and she was going on 2 and 3 dates a week, more dates than all of the single girls that I knew. In fact, some weeks maybe more than all of them combined. Yeah. I was like, okay, how is this 70-something-year-old woman going on more dates than these, you know, beautiful 20-something women? And I started to ask questions. I started to dig more into the history of things. And it turns out that in the 1960s when the pill came out, it changed a lot of the social norms around dating. You know, my grandmother was like, the guys wouldn't even want to kiss you when she was going on dates because they knew you were going to be with a different guy, you know, having soda with a different guy, you know, later that week. And so there was no expectation on behalf of the guy because there was no commitment. It was just a, you know, getting together to get to know you kind of relationship. But as the pill came out, it allowed couples to hide the evidence of their sexual activity. So for many, many years, going back to the Bible, the punishment for fornication was a shotgun wedding. You know, there's even protocols for it. Shotgun wedding costs you 50 shekels in the Old Testament.
Right.
You know, you're forced to make an honest woman out of the woman that you impregnated. But the pill allowed that to be muddled a little bit. And so as baby boomers, as the hippies started injecting the sexual relationship into their romantic relationship, it led to a different set of expectations that brought in expectations of exclusivity and commitment that were unfulfillable expectations because there were no vows. So there was no concept of cheating in my grandmother's day because no vows had been spoken and there was no physical relationship that led to an expectation of exclusivity. And so they stopped using the term going steady altogether. That term kind of faded into the past. Instead, they would say Bobby and Sue are dating. And what that meant was what my grandmother would say, Bobby and Sue are going steady. Mm. And what it implied is Bobby and Sue are sleeping together. So the baby boomer generation, only 10% of them were weddings on their, or were virgins at their wedding, which if y'all want some good news, 15% of millennials when they get married are virgins when they get married. So the virginity rate at the altar has increased 50% from our parents' day. So the trend is in the right direction, although the numbers are far smaller than I think is healthy or good.
Sure.
But anyway, so the thing started to change and it got worse and worse. Mm-hmm. So what started as just a hippie thing in the 60s became more and more mainstream in the 70s and 80s until finally in the 90s, there was this rebellion against it. But instead of going back to the system that worked in the 50s kind of and before that, which had evolved over time, there's a very fascinating history of how the 1950s style of dating evolved and, you know, the different experiments that failed that they tried, like bundling bags, which was kind of fascinating. Watch The Patriot. You can see what that looked like.
I remember that.
Based on the Bible, you know, Ruth and Boaz slept together chastely in the Bible. So it must be a good practice, right? They found that it wasn't a good practice, that just because Ruth did it does not mean that it's a good idea to put your teenage son in bed with a teenage girl and hope that they get to know each other better. Anyway, so some things took us a while to figure out. But anyway, they set aside kind of all of that generational wisdom and went back and kind of created something new, because I kept looking as I was digging through history for courtship kind of as it was in the quote unquote good old days. But America never had a foundation of patriarchy. As a nation, for the most part, we were based on the Protestant doctrine of the priesthood of the believer, where we all have direct access to God through Jesus, and no priest or patriarch or pastor is in between us and God, acting as his kind of voice on earth. And this goes back to John Locke, his essays. I know this is super academic, but for those of you who are listening who are interested, read Locke's essays on government. They're actually essays about patriarchy, because It's the foundation of monarchy in those days. Theologically, it was patriarchy. And so to address the problems of monarchy, Locke first dealt with the problems of patriarchy. And he makes a very, very sound theological case, essentially for a priesthood of believer. So, but that's not what they did. And instead of making relationships less intense and less exclusive, they made relationships more intense and more exclusive. So in modern dating, when a young man asks a young woman out for dinner, what he's really asking is, can I buy you dinner and after then can we have sex? Whereas in modern courtship, what he's really asking is, can I buy you dinner and then later we'll get married and then later we'll have sex? And so it's an even more, it's kind of like even more commitment. And the reality is that no young woman wants to say yes to that to some guy she doesn't know. and most young men don't want to make that ask. And that's, I think, the fundamental flaw of the courtship model, is expecting a young man to commit to a young woman that he doesn't know very well because he's only been allowed to interact with her in a group setting.
I see. Okay, so you're – now, we keep throwing these words out here. Dating, courtship, and you said, of course, that even the term dating had to evolve. It evolved over time since your grandmother's generation coming up to the modern day. We didn't invent the term courtship in the 90s. I know it was a term that goes way, way back, and you talk about that a little bit in your book, which is great. But people may not really understand what courtship, the word courtship, really means. And as you said, trying to define the term is really kind of like hitting a moving target, as you even survey the landscape of people who say they practice courtship as opposed to dating. There's really even no consensus among them exactly what that means. But in your book, you try to lay out several key principles of what you think are more or less common themes of a courtship scenario or a courtship model. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to run through these one by one, and I just want you to just fire off one or two sentences of what you mean by these elements, and we'll just go from there. So maybe if our listeners are familiar with courtship, you could just kind of flesh it out a little bit for us.
Okay.
The first one you mentioned in the book is exclusivity, and you've already kind of fleshed this out somewhat, but exclusivity, what does that mean?
So this is one of the things that modern courtship and modern dating share in common, is this sense that you can only court one person at a time, which seems like a good idea until you realize that that exclusivity leads to a greater degree of emotional attachment, which makes the inevitable breakup, at least in most cases, inevitable breakup, unbelievably heartbreaking. So one of the promises of courtship is that you won't have the heartbreak of modern dating. And, you know, we laugh so that we do not cry, because that's not true. And I have, you know, a huge stack of stories of just the most heartbreaking experiences, because you don't break up a courtship, you call off a courtship, because which is the same language you use for an engagement. Because in many ways, it's since it's so exclusive, you have the same level of emotional attachment, which means, whereas in modern dating, you have a somewhat more frequent breakup cycle. In modern courtship, often it takes years to recover from a broken up courtship, which is years in between of trying to find somebody. And it can be very discouraging.
Sure. I actually had a young woman who contacted me. I was kind of putting out the feelers on there on social media, saying, hey, I'm about to do this interview about courtship. What are your thoughts on it? It had, you know, a lot of vehement reactions in both directions, really kind of interesting little debate that kind of was kind of blew up. And one woman iterated to me that, you know, she'd grown up in a family that practiced courtship, and she didn't describe her parents as being any particular. In fact, she would say that her parents were not particularly stringent or strict about things. They were, you know, they tried to really listen to her about what she was thinking or feeling. But because of the verbiage and the language of the courtship culture that she lived in, that sort of just kind of came through her church or through her youth group or whatever, as she absorbed that language, what it communicated to her was, when she finally did get into a courtship scenario where it was exclusive, she didn't know how to break it off when she knew it wasn't right, because she felt that by breaking it off, she would be in some sense more damaged goods if she cut it off, because to court was to be for the purpose of marriage, was to move towards the purpose of marriage, and this failed. And what does that say about me? And what does that say about this boy that I'm dating? And what does that say about our families or whatever? She didn't know how to communicate all that angst she was feeling over it, despite the fact that her parents were, you know, seemingly pretty open to listening to her about it. But all that language of exclusivity kind of was intimidating to her. It was difficult.
And that concern that she had is a very real concern. I was unable to find in my research a single person who went through a failed courtship who then went through a successful courtship and got married, because that label of being damaged goods is just so strong in the community. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen.
Sure.
And I'm sure that happens somewhere, but it's unbelievably rare. And no one tells these young people, once your first courtship doesn't work, you're not going to be able to court again. And so typically it's not until they're 30, 35 that they finally sign up for eHarmony and start trying something different, which is really tragic, because that whole time in between, they're telling themselves terrible things about themselves. You know, it's because I'm so ugly, or I'm so unwanted, or no girl would ever have me. And the reality is that that's not true. You're just in a system that is not done well by you. And the reality is there's a lot of folks outside of that community who'd be very interested in pursuing you or being pursued by you. But yeah, the damaged goods is that whole language is I think it's very anti-gospel language, because the reality is that we're all damaged goods. None of us can say, I have not sinned. We're all broken.
Right.
If we're going to have any hope of righteousness, it's not because we lived this upstanding life. It's because Jesus died on the cross and made up for all of the mistakes that we made in the past. And so, you know, creating this kind of two-class system of these are the holy ones and these are the unholy ones because they weren't able to do courtship correctly. And another problem with that that's really heartbreaking is these are young people who've never been in a romantic relationship before. They've had no practice interacting with somebody of the opposite sex, often, especially in a one-on-one setting if their community has had strong rules against that. And so it's kind of like expecting someone who's never played high school football to get on a college football team and play really well. It's like, it doesn't work. You can't just step on a college football field and play. It takes a lot of practice to get the confidence to take the hits and to keep on trying. And, you know, these parents are shocked that these young men just don't have any courage to pursue these young women. It's like, well, you told them they couldn't for 10 years. They couldn't practice. And now when they have their one shot, it counts for the rest of their life. It's like, yeah, no wonder they're hesitant. You know, that's really intimidating. I can't imagine any way to make that more intimidating, except for maybe if you have a gun to their head and be like, if this fails, not only will your heart be broken, but we will kill you as well. It's like, maybe that would make it more intimidating. Although talking with some of these young men who are suffering from this heartbreak, you know, some of them might have preferred it that way.
Hmm.
So it's very unfortunate, because these young people want to honor God.
Right.
Now, that was the other thing that shocked me as I was doing this research. And I interviewed many, many young people, and we had hundreds of folks fill out surveys and, you know, contact me one way or another, you know, over 1,000. And that was what shocked me, because there's this narrative, oh, these young people, they don't want to honor God. And it's like, not the young people I'm talking to. They
right.
really want to honor God. They want to walk a righteous path to marriage, but the path that they're on doesn't lead to marriage 9 times out of 10.
Well, I want to get through these descriptions here, and I know there's probably some listeners who are already protesting what you're saying in this whole conversation, because they're saying, well, you never saw courtship the way I experienced it, blah, blah, blah. I get that, and we want to get to that, and I do want to play devil's advocate here in a little bit, but first I want to get to the description of courtship so people really have a firm idea in their mind what we're talking about. I think you're painting a picture of this very well here. So the first description was exclusivity. Second, you mentioned in your book, is, quote, for the purpose of marriage. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Right. So we already talked about this a little bit, but in short, everything in a courtship community between a guy and the girl is, comma, for the purpose of marriage. Can I buy you coffee, comma, for the purpose of marriage, is implied with every statement, whether or not it's spoken. And so that makes everything very awkward, as you can imagine.
Sure.
Asking a girl out to, and I would talk with a young woman who is, you know, in the courtship community, and, you know, some young man had asked her out. And, you know, maybe for the first time, she's like, oh, I couldn't go out with him. It's like, why not? It's like, well, I don't love him. It's like, he just asked you to coffee. He's not asking to marry you. But he was asking to marry her. I mean, that's what it meant, because of, for the purpose of marriage, is such a strong element of courtship in most communities.
I see. Kind of in some ways, very maybe parallel to what you see in a lot of modern dating, which is the implied statement behind asking someone on a date is for the purpose of sex. It's certainly more righteous, but nonetheless, perhaps equally intense, or maybe even more intense, implication behind, can I ask you to coffee for the purpose of marriage? So that's kind of the aura or the atmosphere behind opposite sex interactions in the courtship community. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
Okay.
And, so it's no wonder that people are unlikely to ask and to unlikely to say yes.
Sure.
That's the singleness epidemic.
I see. Now, the third description, you've mentioned exclusivity. 2, for the purpose of marriage. 3, a premium on parental approval. Talk about that.
That's right. So in the most extreme courtship communities, and again, these are all modular definitions. So like you said before, the definition of courtship is the most controversial element, which is somewhat telling, because if it really worked, would we still be arguing over the definition 20 years later? But for some communities, the parents control the entire relationship. And this is seen as, you know, helping because the young people are, you know, they don't have experience, and so the parents controlling is very useful. The problem, though, is that in courtship, parents only have the authority, generally speaking, to say no. So you have this panel of 6 people with a no button and only 2 with a yes button on the relationship. And so, you know, the likelihood of somebody pushing that no button is very high, particularly when you take into account how complicated the relationship becomes. So I actually had an engineer help me with the math on this. So a relationship between 2 people is one relationship, but a relationship between 6 different people is 36 separate one-on-one relationships and hundreds of relationship combinations. So there's like a bunch of different ways that you can make that really complicated. So here's where that's a problem. Let's say some harsh words were spoken in the relationship, or there's been a break in some way, which is, you know, very common. Relationships take work. In a kind of a more traditional model, traditional dating, you could kiss and make up, or side hug and make up. And as long as you resolve that one relationship between the 2 people, the relationship is resolved. You know, the apologies are spoken, forgiveness is offered, what have you. But when you have 36 separate relationships, it's very easy for bitterness to continue to kind of echo in that little chamber of relationships. And you can chase that relationship or those harsh words through these relationships, and maybe the father of the husband doesn't like the father of the girl, you know, and they're fighting, or, you know, there's a lot of ways that this gets really, really complicated, and in practicality, it tends to break down.
Sure.
For just purely mathematical reasons. I know it's not very romantic, but the math is pretty clear that it's a lot of relationships.
Of course, as a software company here, you just said some things that are probably going to make a whole lot of our engineer staff very, very happy. So just want to say that. A lot of left brain folks over there. Anyway, the next one, high accountability, especially high accountability very early in the courtship process.
Right. So chaperones everywhere is the kind of motto of some courtship communities. Again, this is one of the more modular things. Some don't have this. And accountability, I'm in favor of accountability.
Sure.
But the question I want to ask your listeners is, when are you more tempted and when are you in more need of accountability? On the first awkward date when just talking is a challenge, or 2 weeks before the wedding when you know you're going to get married anyway, and what's the harm? The reality is, as you get more committed and as you get more exclusive, the temptation goes up because it's easier to justify to yourself those actions. And so the closer you get to the wedding, the more committed you are, the more you need accountability. Whereas in many courtship communities, it's completely inverted. So there's a younger sibling at the very first date, and there's no accountability whatsoever once the, you know, engagement ring is on the girl's finger. And I think that that's very backward and really unfortunate, because it makes that very first date very difficult. And then when you're really needing that accountability, you don't have it. So it's harmful in both ways.
In some ways, though, a natural outcropping of the system itself, right? If you have a system that promotes exclusivity right out the gate, that the action of engaging in a courtship, of beginning a courtship, is one of exclusivity, is one where parents are heavily involved, is one that is for the purpose of marriage, then in some ways it's kind of if we want to go, I guess, retrofit this back to your grandmother's time, it's like you started out going steady,
right, or even started out being engaged. You know, if the very first thing you did before you asked the girl to coffee was ask the father for permission to court her, for the purpose of marriage, there's only a minor linguistic difference between that and asking for his permission to marry her. marry her. And in many instances, you basically are asking her to marry him, so for permission to get married. And so you're starting off at engagement levels of temptation and then expecting to resist that the whole relationship. And so how most communities deal with this, and families do this, is that they rush the relationship. And so courtships tend to be these kind of whirlwinds. And the downside of that, it makes sense that you rush it because you can get them married sooner and it reduces the time to resist the temptation. But the downside, though, is that I've gotten a lot of feedback from couples who got married through courtship. And the most common phrase is, I felt I married a stranger. They didn't get a chance to really get to know their husband or their wife. And in some cases, they worked through it and they had a very happy marriage. But in some cases, and my heart really goes out to these young women, they didn't realize that they had married a monster. And this man is beating them and is a threat to their children, and they're living in fear and in hiding from this man that they married because they never really got a chance to get to know him and then realize that there's a Dr. Jekyll and there's a Mr. Hyde hiding inside.
Well, let's keep going here. The next one is really an emphasis on including a lot of purity rules. Talk about that.
Right. So I have a whole chapter on this in the book.
Yeah, you do.
And I have to be very, very careful because purity is very important to God. And I want to open by saying that. I also want to say that rules don't make us pure. And depending on the rules to make us righteous is like relying on the law to make us holy. Jesus alone makes us holy. And if we have not been born again, no amount of rules are going to save us. And the downside, there's a lot of downsides of the focus on the rules. And we can lose sight of the gospel the more we focus on the rules. And for me, what kind of set me free from this was the book of Galatians. You know, I hit the book of Galatians. I just started reading it over and over again. And God started reprogramming my mind because this focus on the rules totally happened to the Galatians. They got in on that and they started thinking that circumcision was the way. And I realized that courtship for me was like circumcision was for the Galatians, and that I had lost sight of the gospel because of the focus on rules. So I want to be very careful here because I don't want to justify, you know, immorality or any sort of sin. And if you understand grace and mercy, and I know this is kind of a theme of this podcast, which I really appreciate. Grace is the power of God to do the will of God. And the only way that we can resist sin is by the grace of God giving us the strength to resist sin. So it's the power of God in the present to resist sin and to obey God. To say, oh, I have a lot of grace, therefore I can sin a lot, is a fundamental misunderstanding of grace, because grace is God's unmerited favor giving you the ability to resist sin. It's not giving you permission to sin. And so I don't know if I'm doing a very good job of explaining this.
You're saying, you know, you're preaching Romans 6, 7, 8. This is exactly what Paul's getting into.
Right. So, and it's still something that I'm learning. Like, this is not something I'm an expert in. You know, God is continuing to surprise me and kind of helping me understand better what his grace is and what his mercy is, and a greater appreciation for his grace in my life. And, read Romans 6, 7, and 8, read Galatians, and then look at purity culture through those eyes. And I think that we have our priorities in some cases a little out of kilter.
The next description you have here is intentional and very intense. Now, I think you've kind of already covered this in your descriptions of some of the other things. So just briefly say what you mean by that courtship culture tends to be intentional and very intense.
Right. So, because it's for the purposes, it's basically all of these things, the intentionality and intensity are the fruit of that. And the way that young people would describe this, if you talk to a young person talking about relationships, the word that's going to come up the most often is awkward. And a lot of boomers especially don't understand why everything is so awkward with young people in romance. And it's because things are so intense so soon. And that awkwardness scares a lot of young people away from this process because it can feel a little bit like this gauntlet that they have to run. You know, I was very surprised that many of the folks supporting my book and supporting my blog were couples that had gotten married through courtship. And like, oh, it was a miserable process. We wouldn't wish that on anyone. You know, we're happy we're married, but it was not fun, which is so different from my grandmother. When she talks about dating when she's in junior high, she does it with a twinkle in her eye. These are some of her fondest memories of drinking, you know, milkshakes across the table example, from my grandfather, and, you know, listening to Elvis Presley on the radio or whatever they were listening to. And in some ways, you have to incentivize people to get married. Like, marriage is very scary. Like, the idea of being committed to someone for the rest of your life, that's a little scary. And so society had this kind of slide to help young people slide into marriage where the process of getting married was fun. And when you make the process of getting married not fun, when you make it this beat down, and then the idea of marriage is that it's more beat down of, oh, you're going to be miserable and God's going to be punishing you the whole time and it's going to make you holy and it's going to be great. It's like people are like, pass. And first off, that doesn't reflect reality. There's a wonderful book. I don't know if you've – by Shanti Falhoun. I don't know if you talked with her on the podcast, but her book is Good News About Marriage. And it's about how the divorce rate in the church is far lower than we think it is. The divorce rate in the world was never actually 50%. And not only are most marriages not ending in divorce, but most marriages are also happy and very happy, especially the ones that persist through a season of unhappiness. And that's not what anyone is sharing. And the reality is that marriage doesn't just in general make you happier, but also makes you healthier. Like, when I was researching this book, I was a little worried about using the phrase singleness epidemic. So I was like, well, that might be kind of sensational. But then as I started getting into it and realizing all of the health consequences of staying single, you don't live as long, you're not as happy, you're more likely to get divorced, you're like twice as likely to get Alzheimer's and more likely to get cancer. I mean, it's like you go down the list of like medical harms and it's like all of them. It's like, wow, this is really an epidemic. And if there were a virus that were causing all of these things, we would mobilize all of society to solve it.
The last one you mentioned here is requiring marital readiness. I think this is probably my favorite one here. This is good.
Yeah. So this is, again, it sounds like a great idea. Who wants to get married when they're not married or get married when they're not ready? But the reality is that marital readiness can be kind of like a carrot on the end of a stick that a donkey keeps trying to get to and never gets there. The reality is that I have yet to meet a couple who are like, oh, we were totally ready to get married. They describe it like jumping off a cliff into a pool of cold water. It's really fun, and then it's shocking, and then it's difficult, and then it's fun again. And the other thing that's a little unfortunate is that this is not at all biblical. So the Bible talks a lot about rejoicing in the wife of your youth. The Bible doesn't say its arrows are in the hands of a mighty warrior, so are the children of one's readiness. No, it says, so are the children of one's youth. So the Bible speaks very highly of getting married young. Paul says, marry lest you burn with lust. And so get married. You're obeying God's very first command to humans, which was to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth with babies. So God wants us to get married and have sex. And I think it's easy for us to paint this picture of a God who doesn't like sex. And it's like, no, that's not the God of the Bible. God of the Bible devoted a whole book of the Bible, which is a celebration of sex, which, you know, for a long time, I felt like I was not allowed to read because it was a single man. But it's like, no, he put it in the Bible to remind us that sex is a picture of heaven, and it's the devil that wants us to think that it's actually a doorway to hell, and that's not the case. It is our biggest clue to the mystery that is Christ in the church.
You've been listening to our interview with Thomas Umstadt, Jr., author of Courtship in Crisis. Next week, we'll talk with Thomas again to ask him to really defend his thesis against some of the common criticisms. You can get the rest of our podcasts on iTunes or the Covenant Eyes blog at covenanteyes.com/blog. Be sure to leave a comment or a review and let us know your thoughts on this question. How do you define courtship? What do you like about it? What do you hate about it? And what's your experience with it? Be sure to tell us what you want us to cover in future programs. This is Covenant Eyes Radio, helping you to live a life of integrity in a sex-saturated culture. For the past 30 years, there's been a growing movement among American evangelicals to give a thoughtful response to the problems associated with modern dating. This so-called modern courtship movement has become more and more prevalent in many different Christian communities throughout the Western world. But from both within this movement and from without, there have been criticisms of it. What is modern courtship? And is it the best norm for singles to foster healthy relationships that lead to healthy marriages? Last week, we started our interview with Thomas Umstadt, Jr., author of Courtship in Crisis, The Case for Traditional Dating. Last week, he talked about the marks of modern courtship and some of the underlying problems he sees with the model. This week, he responds to a number of the criticisms that have been thrown his way about his thesis. Before we jump into why you think this is the courtship is a flawed system, which you've already been doing a great job at articulating why you think it's a flawed system. I want you to kind of more systematically do it here in a bit. I really feel like we need to play devil's advocate at this point, because I know quite a few people who were definitely raised in what they would describe as a courtship culture. They courted, they got married, and they would say they've been happily married for the last 15 years. If modern courtship is flawed, why do we know that these people exist? In other words, people, I mean, there might be some people who aren't getting married. They're intimidated. They're frustrated. They're afraid to be asked out. They're afraid to say yes when they are asked out. They're afraid to ask out somebody. They're afraid to do any of that stuff. And then when they do, they end up getting married to some monster, and then they're divorced, and it's awful. So there's that going on. But we meet people, we talk to people who say, well, I courted, and this is, and Thomas, I appreciate that you're saying all this stuff about some courtship people, but that wasn't my experience of courtship. My experience of courtship wasn't nearly so neurotic and intense as you're describing. It was just the name we called dating with real intentionality. It's not at all what you've described. So tell me, if courtship is fundamentally flawed, why are we seeing all these people who are married through courtship?
Yeah. So this is a common question that people bring up, and I'm glad you're asking it, because it allows me to kind of say, for the record, I'm not saying that courtship is universally flawed. It does work for some people, and I totally acknowledge that. Now, some of the folks we thought it worked for, it's turning out it didn't work out so well, kind of as we're getting more time to observe it. But it totally works for some folks, and I have talked with, in my research, many couples who are very happily married, and they got married through courtship. My argument is that it's fundamentally flawed, in the same way that a Yugo is a flawed car design. So people, Yugos really did work. When you bought a Yugo at the store, you could drive it, you know, to school, you could drive it to church, and a skilled mechanic could modify the Yugo, and it would last for 20, maybe 30,000 miles. But it was still a fundamentally flawed design in that it required that kind of mechanic's hand to keep it working. And what I think most singles want in their romance is a car more like a BMW than a Yugo. So a BMW, I would argue, is not a flawed car design. It's a car design that works. Now, that doesn't mean it still doesn't need maintenance from time to time. And I think that's another kind of on the other side of people like, well, you know, look at these people who did traditional dating and it didn't work out for them. You know, I'm not saying that this other one works all the time either. I'm just saying that it works better in general. And I think that, you know, for those of you listening who are happily married and you found a way through courtship, that, you know, great, you know, blessings. You know, I totally support you. I just would ask that, you know, perhaps as you talk with the frustrated singles around you, that you not treat courtship as the only way to find marriage or the only way that God has given us to find marriage, because I think that that's a bit unfair to the folks that it's not working for.
Sure. So I want to quote here someone who is a longtime promoter of the courtship model. In some ways, is one of the people responsible for the genesis of the modern courtship movement, Doug Wilson. He writes in a book, it's written by several people. He sort of contributed one of the main essays to it. The book's called Five Paths to the Love of Your Life. And he says in this book, pretty eye-opening statement, he says that the problems that arise do not arise because of courtship, but rather because of sins such as dishonesty, lust, a domineering spirit, and so on. This is also the problem in other models as discussed in this volume. The problem is not the model, the problem is the people. And so the question that faces those who are arguing for one model over the other is not whether people will sin in the name of this model. The question is which model best anticipates and guards against the inevitable sin. So my first question to you would be, dismissing the fact that, of course, he's now going to leap into saying, and courtship is that model. So that's, he's going to defend that. So aside from that, just on the surface, would you agree with that statement?
So we have a saying in business that the system you have is perfectly designed to give you the results that you're getting. And if you want to fix problems in the real world, you're smart to look at the system first. God created the institution of marriage before he created the institution of the church, before he created the institution of the government. And you can go in cultures that don't yet have the gospel in a meaningful way, and they don't have a singleness epidemic, and yet they have lots of sin. And so I think that it's a bit of a cop-out to say, oh, it's just because they're sinful people. The model is, you know, perfect, but it's people that mess it up. And it's like, well, every model's going to have sinful people, but not every culture has a singleness epidemic where you have a whole generation of young people that are walking away from the institution of marriage unless we do something to kind of win back their hearts towards marriage. And so I don't know if Doug Wilson kind of realizes the enormity of the problem that we're facing. I mean, this, I don't want to overstate it, but marriage is really important to society. If we don't restore the institution of marriage in the church, if Christians aren't embracing marriage in majority, and of course, some Christians are called to singleness. They aren't part of the singleness epidemic. They're not part of the problem. I'm talking about folks that are called to get married, which I think is safe to say is majority of Christians. If we walk away from marriage, our society will collapse, or it will form something that is different and broken in ways that we're not going to be comfortable with. Because as the marriage breaks down, as the family breaks down, the government steps in to compensate, you know, and the government does more and more and takes away more and more liberties. And we become less and less of who we are as a people, which, you know, I like being an American. I like freedom. I don't want to see those things undermined. And I don't think courtship's the answer to sin. I think the Holy Spirit is the only one who can regenerate our hearts. And looking for an apparatus of rules to make us holy won't work, but it will make the singleness epidemic worse.
So I think if I know, having read my fair share of Doug Wilson stuff, I think there'd be a lot of, if he was sitting in the room with us right now having this conversation, there'd be probably about 70-80% of the things you just said he would be nodding his head in agreement with, and the other 20-30% he would be just shaking it, no. The stuff he would be probably agreeing with you in spirit is, well, of course rules don't change people, the Holy Spirit does. Well, of course the gospel is what we really need. Of course marriage is important for society. Like, he'd probably agree with all that stuff. I know he would agree with all that stuff. However, he's coming at this saying, you've pegged courtship wrong. If you ever are out there in his private Christian school that they run out there at St. Andrews, the church he runs out there, he says, you know, we have a whole lot of people who have more or less embraced a courtship culture, and a lot of people get together, a lot of people get married, and we see a lot of people very, very happy. Whatever version of courtship you've been experiencing, Thomas, whatever version of courtship you're hearing from stories people pouring in, is people just not applying the model well, or people misunderstanding the model, or people not really embracing the spirit of the gospel behind the model. Instead, what you're noticing here is, you know, the sins that are inherent to people within the model, inherent to people that are using this model. But you're saying there's actually something about the model itself that it more or less encourages the kind of sinful behaviors that people experience that are making getting together really, really difficult. Is that right?
So I think one of the big differences between Doug Wilson and myself, and I quote him in my book, so I did research quite a bit of Doug
Sure.
Wilson's position, and in many ways the courtship I'm responding to is very much the courtship that he's advocating.
Okay.
So in Doug's view, or Mr. Wilson's view, the primary problem is just this wickedness, you know, sin-saturated culture.
Sure.
Which I agree is a problem. What I also see as a problem that I have not seen him address or mention or reference a single time, either in his writings or on his blog, and he may have that I haven't seen it, but I haven't found it, is an acknowledgement of the generation that's abandoning marriage. And I don't know what the numbers are in his particular church or his school. I imagine with his kind of careful eye, they're probably better than the average. But what I have seen is that the more that communities embrace that concept of courtship, and Doug Wilson's version of courtship is quite strong. So when he's talking
Sure.
about courtship, he's not talking about courting the girl's heart and winning the girl's heart through some sort of romantic pursuit. He's talking about courting the father's heart, who gives his daughter in marriage to the son. And so in many ways, it's the value system of kind of the arranged marriage betrothal Mm-hmm. of the Old Testament without all of the mechanics of it. So Mm-hmm. without parents helping match young people, without a bride price being paid. And the more I've researched this, actually, I've realized that bride prices were really critical for the biblical system of courtship. Because if the father owns the daughter, she's a form of property, She is giving him, the father, free labor being in the home, being a nanny or a servant of some sort, serving the home. And so he has a incentive to keep her at home and get the benefit of her labor that she's, you know, only compensated through room and board. Now, the biblical model compensates for that by giving him a financial incentive to marry off his daughter, to sell her into marriage through the payment of a bride price, which was, depending on the wealth of the family, a fairly significant sum. So 50 shekels is like a lot of money. I don't want to do the conversion, but if you look it up on Google, you can kind of get what the dollars are in today's inflation. And so there's a conflict of interest when you take out bride prices from that system. So if you want to copy the biblical system, you have to copy the whole thing. If you start taking out elements, it's not going to work as well as it worked back then. And bride prices were the heart of it. And I was at first very kind of curious, why don't we see bride prices in any of these courtship communities? Even the super conservative ones don't have bride prices. And then a friend pointed out that that would be illegal. After the Civil War, we passed the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. We made selling people illegal. Slavery is not a thing in the United States that we condone officially anymore. And so that can't be a part of it. And so it creates a conflict of interest. So if you imagine a parent who's got a lot of children and an older daughter who's helping to parent the younger children, the conflict of interest is one of love. The parent loves their other children and wants the daughter to stay and help take care of those other children. The parent also loves the daughter and wants her to be happy and healthy. So even assuming that there's no selfishness, there's no sin in the parent's life, it's purely benevolent feelings, it's still a conflict of interest between conflicting benevolent feelings, because your daughter can't be married to some other man and a part of his household and still serving your household.
So, I don't know
if that answers your
question. No, it does. It gets into some of these elements here, because I'm sure I know a lot of our listeners who've even been married through what they would deem it to be a courtship model of getting together. They are going to, if they were to hold up their experiences next to some of the most conservative practitioners and promoters of courtship, they're going to say, oh, wait a second, that really wasn't what I experienced. That's just not what I saw. You would say that was essentially someone taking the Yugo car, retrofitting it, by taking out certain key elements, but only so much so that you could still call it a Yugo, but it's a very different looking vehicle. You're talking about, you've taken away, for instance, I know a lot of people who they say they courted, but the parental oversight and involvement was far less intense than other scenarios. Or they might say the accountability was there, but it was far less intense. The for the purpose of marriage was more like I'm not just dating to mess around with your heart. I'm dating in order to get to know you well, in order so that if I get to know you well and I like you and you like me, then we will get married. It's not as much. It wasn't this feeling of intensity that you're describing. And what you're saying though is that it's whether that's traditional dating that we're just calling courtship, or whether that is courtship that has just been dramatically boiled down and reduced to just certain key elements. You're saying that the whole model itself is fundamentally, not universally, but fundamentally flawed system. Is that right?
That's right. It's fundamentally flawed, and the fixes that different families do to make it work are different for each family, which is why the definition is so controversial.
Okay.
Because they may fix these three things and it's able to get the Yugo to go far enough to get to the destination, whereas a different family fixes a different three things, but those three things were enough to fix it to get to the destination. And for some people, when they're saying courtship, what they're really meaning is dating without the sex and without the physical relationship. Mm. And so in some people's minds, dating and sex are so closely connected that the concept of Christian dating or traditional dating is an oxymoron, because it's like, well, but dating involves sex. And that's one of the big things I'm trying to dispel in this book. And part of the reason why I also go after modern dating, because a lot of folks are like, oh, you're advocating modern dating. It's like, no, I have a whole chapter about why modern dating is a bad idea. You don't have to believe in the Bible to believe that modern dating is broken. There is an abundance of evidence in the social science and in common sense that will explain why modern dating is broken. And even if you're a secular person, there are very valid reasons to wait to have sex until you get married. One of the most proven things in social science when it comes to relationships is that cohabitation leads to a higher divorce rate. Mm-hmm. The first studies that found this were 20 and 30 years ago, and the scientists just didn't believe it. And they kept doing the study over and over again. They've done it in different countries. They've done it in Europe. They've done it in the United States. Every single time they found cohabitating doesn't just lead to higher divorce. It leads to lower marital satisfaction. It leads to more spousal abuse. I call it a toxic cocktail of marital misery. It's a bad idea. And you don't have to believe in the Bible to believe that. When folks are saying that I'm advocating for this kind of sex-saturated modern dating, again, the issue is one of definitions.
Right.
And I know people don't want to talk about definitions, but that's not what I'm arguing for. And if you read the book, Courtship in Crisis, I go out of my way to differentiate between traditional dating and modern dating. I capitalize the terms. I treat them as characters in the book because I don't think any one person is responsible for this. What I see is this problem that we're seeing is mostly a result of societal forces. And they are very, very fixable. And that was the other thing that surprised me. Traditional dating never fully died out. As I've been doing research for this book, I found many communities that still practice it who are not experiencing the singleness epidemic. People are getting married and are staying married, and they're very happy. And that was a huge surprise to me. I was like, where's your community been hiding? Teach us your ways. This really does work, and it's very easy, and it's fun, and it honors God, this new model.
When people were contacting me about this interview that I'm doing now with you, they were saying, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, it's not about the labels, it's not about the rules, it's not about any, you know, let's forget about the words, let's forget about terms, let's forget about norms, and let's just do what the Holy Spirit says is right. Let's just follow the Bible. Let's just do this. And I politely told them, I said, well, I get what you're saying in spirit. The problem is that as long as it's just an individual trying to make individual choices for their life and they're trying to obey the scriptures, that they can go pretty far in that. However, once you start talking about two people or whole families of people coming together, you need social norms. And traditional dating was a norm, a social norm that said, if you want to get people together, this is a fun way to do it. Courtship is another social norm. If you want to get people together, this is a way to do it. This is how we can get them from pure singleness up to the altar. So these are norms. And so the norms are important. But one of the criticisms that I kept hearing over and over and over again, and especially as someone who was in public school myself and didn't even really interact with homeschoolers ever in my childhood, I found this criticism kind of interesting regarding your position, is a number of people who especially were reading your articles online or taking in your information or even reading your book were saying, well, look, Thomas has got a lot of good things to say. He hits the nail right on the head. He really nails down why certain parts of courtship are really, really bad. But he's diagnosed the problem wrong. Thomas is really only the kind of courtship he is seeing is that's so dysfunctional is not so much a result of the model of courtship, but rather a result of other elements of the subcultures that these people are growing up in, such as, for instance, being a homeschooler. If you take the real problems here are courtship plus homeschooling. If you don't have a natural social environment for kids to be interacting with on a fairly regular basis, like going to a Christian school or going to a public school where they can really be together and be in different social scenarios and stuff like that. If they're always kind of isolated and off to themselves and not interacting with other people, and then you try to throw them into courtship, well, that's what the problem is that you've taken away the in-between step of the social, natural social interactions. And because you've done that, that's where courtship breaks down. So the real problem is not the courtship, it's the homeschooling. What would you say to that?
So I've run across that argument as well. In fact, sure. Some homeschooling parents are like, yeah, homeschooling was a mistake. I was like, you spent 20 years homeschooling your children. Now you're saying that it's a mistake. I think that what we're seeing is mostly correlation more than causation. Yes, when courtship is combined with a strong kind of patriarchal homeschool isolated family, that tends to those – the issues in those systems reflect off of each other to really isolate those young people. So like when you combine courtship with the stay-at-home daughter doctrine, where daughters are the property of their fathers and they should stay at home serving the family until they're given in marriage. When you combine that with courtship, that daughter is very isolated, and it's very rare to see a stay-at-home daughter actually get married because of that combination. But I went to a Christian college, and there was a lot of students who had been public schooled and private schooled who believed in courtship in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And the more they believed in courtship, the less likely they were to get married. And so in general, and so I don't think that, you know, if you just took homeschooling off the table, I still don't think it would address the issues with courtship. Although I will agree that some issues in homeschooling combine with some of the issues in courtship to make it, that's where you see the worst horror stories. And part of the reason I use them in the book, because it was kind of pure refined versions of what these real harms look like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's still a problem of folks who didn't go in the homeschool community. Right. And in some ways it's worse because let's say you're a college student and you got saved in college. Your parents are not believers.
Okay.
How do you do courtship? You can't really.
Right.
It is broken for you. And so you right off the bat, you're damaged goods because you didn't grow up as a Christian. You've got probably some sort of past. And that value system of damaged goods does not accommodate redemption, forgiveness. It's like, you know, once you get the damaged goods label, you got to die to get rid of it. It's like, no, you don't. Jesus died so you could get rid of it. But it doesn't work very well for you. And so I think part of the reason why there's so many stories of it happening in homeschooling is that where people are trying it the most. And so that's where the most of the problems are, which is going back to the causation and correlation. So again, the fundamental flaw, I have to commit to marrying you before I can get to know you on a one-on-one basis. That's the core flaw. And that's not a homeschooling issue or a private schooling issue or public schooling issue. That's just a cart before the horse. For a young man to commit the rest of his life or to a young woman, he's got to get to know her first. I just don't see most young men being willing to jump off that cliff and you know, talk to a father to get permission to pursue a young woman that he doesn't know. And, you know, maybe she's just stunningly beautiful, or they were able in a group setting to have some one-on-one interactions, but I just don't see that working very often or very well, regardless of the academic background. But I do understand the frustration, you know, doing the research on this.
Yeah.
It's really hard to find studies on homeschooling because the social scientists that study subcultures don't see homeschoolers as a sociographic subunit. They see it as an academic approach. And so they don't study it. They're not asking the right questions when they're studying homeschooling. And so when we're going through big data sets, it's really hard to pull out any sort of useful information, because homeschooling is very broad. It's not just a bunch of
for sure
religious fundamentalists. There's a huge spectrum of people who homeschool across the political spectrum, across the religious spectrum. In fact, the very first homeschoolers were hippies. They were the very first pioneers who were very anti-establishment. And there's still that strain in homeschooling. You know, they brew their own moonshine and grow their own marijuana and they homeschool. And it's very different, but it's just as old of a stream as the kind of evangelical homeschoolers or the academic homeschoolers.
Sure. Now, you say in the book, I pulled this quote out because I thought it was interesting and I wanted you to explain it. Modern courtship was intended to take us back to our roots. It, in fact, did just the opposite. So flesh this out. In what sense does modern courtship actually take us away from our roots? What do you even mean by our roots?
So when I'm talking about our roots, I'm talking about our roots as American culture. So in the 1700s and the 1800s, parents were very hands-off with relationships. In fact, parents were very hands-off in general. I think a modern parent would be horrified at how parents parented in the first two centuries of this country, because it wasn't there was no helicopter parents. You know, one professor said that the cell phone is the world's longest umbilical cord. You know, my own mother, who tells stories of, you know, being away from the house for, you know, hours, you know, in the neighborhood. My dad was the same way. And, you know, you go back a little bit farther and there's, you know, you look at stories in Tom Sawyer of, you know, couples going to a cave with no light but a candle and no parental supervision. You know, those were the social norms back in the day. That's how parents parented. And so they didn't have this concept of control and permission. And that's a very old world approach. That's a very old world thinking. So that's what I mean by we don't have this history of right. courtship. And how they took us even farther is that what the trend was, starting with the sexual revolution, of adding intensity and exclusivity. That's the trend. Courtship didn't go against that trend. It accelerated that trend. It added even more intensity and even more exclusivity. And so in many ways, courtship wasn't nearly as countercultural as we thought it was. The purity movement was certainly countercultural, but courtship as a system of making things more intense wasn't countercultural. It was accelerating social norms that were already happening. Another example of this is this doctrine of the season of singleness. So there's a social trend of young people waiting longer and longer to get married. And some Christians came and basically sprinkled holy water on that social trend and be like, oh, this is a biblical principle of embracing singleness for a season and going on mission trips and then waiting to get married. That's not in the Bible. There is no season of singleness in the Bible. It talks about, as we said already, the wife of your youth, the children of your youth. It's not to say that there's not a season for everything. So I guess you could make an argument from Ecclesiastes that for everything there's a season. But to say that everyone must go through the season of singleness is just accelerating a pre-existing social trend that personally I don't think is a healthy trend. I think that delaying marriage is not a good thing for society. I think we were created in pairs. You know, it was not good for Adam to be alone. So God very quickly created Eve so that he wouldn't be alone. And so perpetuating that and extending that, I don't think is a good trend. And I certainly don't think it's something that we should advocate for from the pulpit.
Well, thank you, Thomas, for saying that. I really want to get back to this notion next week, though, because I think a lot of parents are saying to themselves, look, I get why courtship doesn't take us back to the roots of American culture, but that's not what I want anyway. I have a serious responsibility to raise my children in righteousness, and I don't want a hands-off approach the way my American ancestors did. So next week, we'll talk more about why you think the traditional dating model is still the best model, even for families who feel a strong sense of parental responsibility, and even for teens and young adults who desire their parents to be involved in their dating lives. And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. You can get our podcasts on iTunes or the Covenant Eyes blog at covenanteyes.com/blog. Be sure to leave a comment or a review and let us know your thoughts on this topic. Thomas says the fundamental flaw with courtship is that the model provides no social context for individuals to get to know one another on a one-on-one basis before they make the commitment to exclusivity and the inevitable intensity of pursuing a relationship that is for the purpose of marriage. So let us know if you agree or disagree. Is this endemic to the nature of the courtship model? And if so, is it a genuine obstacle, the way Thomas often says it is? Let us know your thoughts. In the comments or reviews, be sure to tell us what you want us to cover in future programs. And until next week, this is your host, Luke Gilkerson, signing off. This is Covenant Eyes Radio, helping you to live a life of integrity in a sex-saturated culture. For the past 30 years or so, there has been a growing movement among American evangelicals to give a really thoughtful response to the problems associated with modern dating. And so this so-called modern courtship movement has become more and more prevalent in many different Christian communities throughout the Western world. But both from within this movement and from without, there have been numerous criticisms of it. What is modern courtship? And is it the best social norm for singles to foster healthy relationships that lead to healthy marriages? 2 weeks ago, we started our interview with Thomas Umstadt Jr., author of Courtship in Crisis, The Case for Traditional Dating. 2 weeks ago, he talked to us about the marks of modern courtship and some of the underlying problems he sees with the model. Last week, he responded to a number of criticisms he often hears about his ideas. And this week, he will explain what he calls traditional dating, something unlike modern dating and unlike modern courtship. He talks especially to parents and to young singles about why he thinks this model works really well. I want you to first of all tell us not so much what's wrong with courtship, because we've kind of been already talking about that, but what is right about the traditional dating model that you could tell to someone who still has that strong feeling of, I have a responsibility, I am the patriarch of my home, this isn't a power trip for me, this is a genuine, I believe God has called me to this, I don't want to be hands-off, I want to be hands-on with my children. Help me see why traditional dating is a good idea.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yeah, because it's really striking at a big societal trend, which is helicopter parenting, which expands far beyond the patriarchy movement, which is
sure
a flavor of this trend of even secular parents being very involved with their children and very controlling of their children. And I want to clarify that I'm not arguing that parents should be uninvolved.
Okay.
I think that parental involvement is very important in the romantic relationship, and I explain that in the book, what that involvement looks like. It's a role of a coach, which is, I think, really critical of the young person coming to the parent and seeking advice and learning how to make their own decisions, which is different from parental control, where it's the parent making the decisions. There's a big difference between control and influence. And the kind of parent who thinks that no control is no involvement is the kind of parent who's likely to have unhealthy control issues. Because ultimately, hopefully as a parent, your goal for your child is to be a fully actualized adult who's able to make their own good decisions on their own without needing you to make those decisions for them. And hopefully that process is starting of learning how to make decisions is starting really young. So I have a podcast on writing, and I co-host it with a Christian author, James L. Rubards, best-selling author, and he's got this model for parenting that I really like. He says that his relationship with his sons changed over time from dictator to coach to friend. So when his children were toddlers, it was do not go on the street. But there comes a point when they need to go on the street. You know, you can't leave the house if you can't go on the street. And so there came a time when his son had to sit behind the steering wheel and not just go on the street, but go on the street purposefully. And his relationship with his son had to shift from being a dictator to being a coach. And now that his sons are adults and you know, one of them just got married, he has a different relationship, which is that of a friend, where they are both brothers in Christ together. And his sons seek his advice. You know, frequently I seek my father's advice, and I really respect his advice because he's proven to be trustworthy, and I trust his advice. And James Rubart has the same relationship with his sons, where his sons seek his advice, but ultimately they are taking his advice into consideration and making their own decisions, which I think is the more healthy model.
I think if I could just jump into the ears of a listener right now who's maybe feeling somewhat detached from these issues, and they're saying to themselves, okay, I get it. People don't agree on definitions. I get it. There's these different models out there. I get that some people really had a really just terrible experience in these different models, and in this particular case, courtship. And you know what? I can't untangle all the theological wires at this point regarding how this connects to, you know, 4,000 years of history, how this connects to my American heritage, how this connects to the Bible, or anything else for that matter. Just tell me what works, Thomas. Tell me what's going on here. So why don't you just take a second here, and I want to say for the record, your book is very refreshing. It was a very fun read, good read, a lot of great stories in it. So it was really good. Some really excellent research that went into this. Even if a lot of it is anecdotal evidence coming in from people who are kind of pouring into your former website, as well as now this new initiative, as you're trying to talk about traditional dating, you're gathering all these stories, as you said, well over 1,000 stories, people talking about this stuff. Tell us right now, traditional dating, what is it? It's pretty, it's ruthlessly simple in a lot of ways. You really only mentioned a few kind of step by step. This is what traditional dating looks like. You go from this to this to this, and then really only a couple rules, if you want to call them that, rules of engagement. What is it?
Okay, yeah. So there's four steps of traditional dating and two rules. So if you think of this as a staircase, there's two handrails on both sides and four steps. So the first step is dating. And by dating, I mean going out with different people. And it really does work. Your heart is much less drawn out with somebody when you go out with somebody else next. And it gives you an ability to compare and contrast. It's like, I really liked this about this one person. I really did not like this about this other person. And it's still for the purpose of marriage in the sense that you're getting information to figure out who you're a good match with. So the whole idea of dating is that you're trying to find somebody who's a good match that makes the marriage easier. Does that mean that once you get married and you think you're a bad match, that's an excuse to get divorced? Absolutely not. Does that mean that two people can be a perfect match? Maybe, but I think there's always issues to work through. But the fewer issues there are to work through,
right,
I think the easier the marriage is. And ultimately, that's what we want. So you're going on with different dates with different people. That's step one. And then there's one person who's caught your eye, or you've caught somebody's eye. The second step is going steady. And typically here, there's some sort of ask. In the olden days, there would be some sort of visual token. So often, like, the girl would wear the guy's letter jacket. And that would mean that she's no longer accepting date requests from other guys. And they're starting to be identified together as a couple. And they're receiving community feedback, both from their family and from their community of friends on their relationship. And so, which I think is really important, because one of the modifications of courtship is to keep everything secret because of how intense things are. It's like, wow, if we let our whole community know, it's just going to make things more intense and awkward, which is really unfortunate, because there are things that your friends can tell you about this person that you're in a relationship with that your family may not know. You may really want to know that. And so getting that feedback from the community is very similar. And in the going steady phase, typically for children, people who aren't adults yet, before they go steady, they ask permission of their own parents. So if Bob wants to go steady with Sally, he asks his own parents. Sally wants to go steady with Bob, she asks her own parents. And if the parents say yes, then they go steady. And then in the traditional model, once they're adults, they make that own decision. But even when they're adults, before they transition into step three, which is engagement, Bob would ask Sally's father for his blessing on the marriage. Mm-hmm. And engagement has survived more or less intact through the courtship crisis and through the sexual revolution. And so in between the two models, engagement's pretty similar.
Sure.
I can't think of any difference, except for in modern dating, engagement typically means cohabitation, which I'm not advocating for on religious and practical grounds. I don't recommend it. And if any of you listening are cohabitating, make an honest woman out of that girl and marry her. That may be bad to give that as general advice, but I'm going to say it generally. You need to seek God for your own life. And then finally, the fourth step is marriage, where you get married. And again, that is the same. So those are the four steps with traditional dating. The two rules, and there was when we were writing this book, there was a lot of hubbub about whether or not to use the words rules.
Because I'm sure,
like, you've been going on and on about rules. Why have rules? And so I want to point out that these are common sense rules. They are not biblical rules. You're not sinning if you're violating them. Violating them doesn't make you more holy, or following them doesn't make you more holy. The rules just help you be more successful. So the first rule is, don't go steady too soon. This is a real mistake. A guy starts to get your attention. A girl starts to, you know, win your heart, and you're wanting to go steady and just be with her. And
right.
The reason you don't want to do this too soon is that that's what leads to heartbreak. You know, until you're going steady, there's very little, or there shouldn't be, very much commitment. There's not much on the line. If it turns out that you're not a good fit, you go out with other folks, and there's very little pain. There's very little harm, but there's a lot of learning. So you've learned, you know, something about yourself. You've learned something about what you're looking for. And you'll notice that that's kind of vague. Too soon is vague on purpose, because too soon for one person isn't necessarily the same as too soon for somebody else. I think, generally speaking, the older you are, the sooner you can go steady, because you have a better sense of who you are and of what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. The younger you are, the more you're trying to figure out who you are as a person. And I think this is one of the benefits of traditional dating, is that you get to know yourself through traditional dating as much as you get to know these other people. And it's especially helpful for people who are homeschooled, because a lot of folks who are homeschooled have never really gotten to figure out who they are outside of the context of their family, because they're always around the same people every day. And so who they are as an individual, sometimes they don't even know that. And so being in around other people who aren't a part of that core can start to give them more context, more data, to use a very scientific, non-romantic term.
Sure.
The second rule is not to stay out too late. This was really fascinating. I found this really was a rule in traditional dating, was not to stay out too late. And It's like, why are curfews important? Well, there's actually some really solid social science and neuroscience behind the common sense of our grandparents, and it has to do with willpower. So there's been some – this Professor Brumhauser has wrote a wonderful book on willpower and did a bunch of really fascinating experiments and found that we have essentially one reservoir of willpower in our bodies. And we make draws on that willpower throughout the day. So, you know, I want to get a snack at the vending machine, but I exercise willpower and I save my money and I don't buy the bag of chips. That's a small draw on willpower. Even making decisions draws on willpower. And so typically by the end of the day, we've depleted our reservoir of willpower, and it's a lot easier to make bad decisions that we would regret in the morning when our reservoir is full again. And so, you know, there's a saying that my grandfather used to say, is there's nothing good that happens after midnight.
Right.
My dad used to say, he who hoots with the owls by night cannot soar with the eagles by day. But there's another practical reason as a young woman that you don't want to stay out too late is that you want to always leave the man wanting more so he continues to pursue you. And so cutting things off early not only reduces the temptation because you're both going to bed before your willpower is depleted, but it also makes him, you know, he wants to spend more time with you, hopefully, if he's interested. So he's going to then continue to pursue you and ask you out on another date, and the cycle perpetuates itself. And so there's a lot of practical reasons for it. But again, what is too late? Well, you know, that depends. You know, when my grandmother would be going out on dates, you know, she's 78 years old, 79 years old, and I would tell her, now, don't stay out too late. I found it very funny because the idea of a 79-year-old woman being out too late, you know, is comical to me. Maybe it's not funny to anybody else. But, you know, I would imagine it would be different for her at 79 than it would be, you know, for a 16-year-old. And so, again, that's where the parental involvement really comes in, because I think parents can coach their children as to how soon is too soon and how late is too late. Those are questions that young people really need advice on. And as parents show themselves trustworthy in giving advice, and what I mean by this is giving advice that's for the benefit of your children and not for the benefit of yourself, because this is one of the areas where I see parents sometimes can lose their trustworthiness, is that the decisions that they're making seem arbitrary or seem to benefit the parent in some way. You lose your credibility that way. You know, as parents make deposits, you know, emotional deposits, their children are wanting their advice, and that has been, you know, they're wanting the advice, they're not wanting control. And I think you'd be surprised in giving advice how often they take it.
To quote again someone we've quoted a couple times in this podcast, although not someone is on your side of the fence of things, is Doug Wilson. He actually gives the same kind of advice regarding parental authority. You know, that there's really a couple of different kinds of parental authority. You have your more authority by structure kind of thing. That's like whose name is on the checkbook, right? I'm the signature on the account. I'm the one who writes the checks. I'm the one who makes the withdrawals. Versus the relational authority, or the kind of is there money in the bank? Are you making emotional deposits into your children? And, you know, some parents, they make the mistake of thinking, well, if I just make a lot of deposits, I'll never need to make withdrawals, right? If I just put a lot of money in the bank, I'll never need to write a check. Well, that doesn't work, because then you just end up being a pushover parent and the kids can walk all over you. Some parents, though, especially those in the more conservative circles, maybe more legalistic circles, they have the opposite approach. And this is what you see a lot of times in certain court, maybe not every, but in certain courtship circles, which is the opposite. It's, I must have money in the bank because I've still got checks left. Well, that doesn't work, because just because you have checks doesn't mean you have money. Just because you are technically the signature on the account doesn't mean you've actually deposited anything into the child that make them want to listen to you. And so we need the both. We need to have, fathers, bring your children up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, and then do not exasperate them. Like, if we're constantly exasperating them by our demands, our uninvolvement or emotional, you know, disconnectedness by our authoritarianism, by whatever it is, and then we're trying to bring them up in the discipline instruction of the Lord, we're going to find ourselves banging our heads against a whole lot of walls. Either that or going to be raising a whole lot of children who just are complying, but underneath deeply, deeply miserable people. And so it's difficult, I think, to for parents to do this. I think courtship is feels like a very safe net for a lot of people. It's a system that is one, it maintains a sense of tight control. But as you've articulated here, your opinion really is that if our goal is to raise adults and not just large children, if our goal is to raise adults, then we need to have a system of dating, a system of getting together that allows those budding adults to really make decisions and finding out who they are. And you're saying traditional dating is really the way to do that.
That's right. Arrows don't change the world if they stay in the quiver. Mm. And it takes courage and a willingness to, you know, hold your children with an open hand to let them go out as arrows into the world. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many arrows you have and how beautiful they are. If they stay in the quiver, they're not going to make a difference. But if you allow your children to follow God themselves, I think you'd be shocked at the wonderful lives that they live and the amazing difference they make in a world that's desperate for people who are passionate for God to, you know, be engaging the world instead of hiding from it. And I truly believe that the light is stronger than the darkness, and that and you have to believe that. You have to believe that God is more powerful and that He can hold your children through the trials that they're going to go through. And yes, they're going to go through trials. We all go through trials. And you know, protecting somebody from trials isn't doing them a favor. It's like having a student go through school and not giving them tests. You know, there is a function that those trials serve. You know, even Jesus went through trials. You know, God specifically had him tested because he needed to be tested. It was a part of his development as a man and as a son of God, and he needed the confidence that can only come through hard times. And so, you know, it can be hard as a parent, and I know a lot of mothers especially want to keep those apron strings really close. And I just want to say that sometimes loving your children means allowing them to go through hard times to be led by God through those hard times.
Last question I have really about this whole thing, regardless of what model I may think is best or what model you may think is best, isn't part of the problem the social norms in which we live? For instance, you mentioned, and I mentioned as well, if you grew up in a culture, in a family that didn't have norms for this stuff, or at least not stated norms, maybe you were raised in a non-Christian home and became a Christian later on in college or whatever, then courtship, as it is espoused by its most able promoters, is a difficult system or impossible system to implement the way they describe it, because it involves so many other people and factors, especially parents and whatever else. So social context determines in some ways that. Well, isn't the same true for traditional dating? In other words, if I say, Thomas, I love your book, I cannot wait to start implementing this in my life, and then I start just saying, hey, I'd like to ask you out for coffee. I'd like to ask you to do this, do that, do the other thing. Isn't the mentality of the person you're asking to go on a date, isn't the mentality of the multiple people that you're asking out on dates or that you're being asked, isn't their perception of what taking you out on a date, doesn't that perception somehow in many ways taint the experience? If I am sort of from this, if you're asking me out, it means this. It means commitment. It means exclusivity. It means you like me. It means you want to marry me. It means whatever it is. They have this sort of very, very intensified system of, well, you just asked me out. This is what this means. Doesn't that make traditional dating hard if everyone around you doesn't also agree with it?
It can. So you're using the term social norms, which I think is a scary word for a lot of folks. It sounds very academic, but that's exactly what the issue is kind of these behaviors that people have. And, you know, in the book, I try to use the word recipes. I have this metaphor of chocolate chip cookies, you know, base recipe of chocolate chip cookies you can modify, but, you know, the core recipe is the social norm. I will tell you one thing that young people are starting to do to help address this, and they're taking selfies with my book. If you go on Facebook, there's lots of young folks who are taking selfies with my book. And well, I appreciate that it has a book marketing benefit. The real benefit, though, is that as a young woman, if you have a selfie with my book, it signals to the young men, you can ask me out to coffee without me interpreting it as a invitation to get married. And when a young man does it, it's the same way in reverse. It's when I'm asking you for coffee, I'm just wanting to get to know you better, and it's not a proposal of marriage. And it's a very easy way to signal to your community, hey, I'm available, you know, to be asked out to coffee. And I've heard wonderful results. Like, the book's only been out for, you know, a few weeks, and already people are going on all kinds of dates. At my launch party generated probably dozens of dates as young men were asking out young women, because for the first time they felt like they had the permission. And some of these young women were 26, 27 years old, beautiful, loved God, never been asked out on a date a single time because no guy knew them well enough to be ready to ask them out. And they're getting asked out for the very first time. And it really fills me with hope, because what's cool about traditional dating is that this isn't a system that I made up. It's a system that was proven to be a good fit for American culture over 250 years of experimentation and a lot of dead ends and a lot of hard lessons learned. And this is what resulted, was a system that works pretty well most of the time and is very compatible, culturally compatible with our worldview. And yes, some people are like, we should have an ancient Hebraic worldview with strong patriarchy, and you know, you want to embrace that. And there's a whole betrothal movement where it's basically arranged marriage and the daughters are given in marriage. You know, if that's your culture and if that's what you're wanting to do and it's working, you know, I'm just trying to solve the singleness epidemic. And so, but I think that for most people, most women want to be pursued and have their heart won, not their father's heart won and then being given to a man that they didn't choose. That may be controversial in some circles, but I think that for most young men, it's the same way. They want to marry a woman that they love first. You know, that what was once revolutionary is now commonplace. The once first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the baby and the baby carriage. I think modern dating got mixed up, and I think that these extreme forms of courtship get it mixed up. You know, love's got to come first, then marriage, then the baby. Modern dating puts a baby first. Don't do that. You know, arranged marriage puts the marriage first. I wouldn't do that either. And I think that it works, and it won't work for everyone, but I think it'll work for a lot of folks. And if you're listening and you're frustrated being single and you want to get married and you don't feel like there's a clear path, I encourage you to read Courtship in Crisis, borrow a copy from a friend or check it out at the library and put it into practice and just see if it doesn't work so much better for you in helping you find the love of your life.
Thomas, thank you very much. I know that this is going to generate a lot of discussion for people. I know that people are probably going to be walking away from this, as you probably experience on a fairly regular basis, saying that guy's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's got everything all mixed up. But what's really nice is that people are engaging in the discussion. And I think this is really, really important. It's important not just for people who are single looking to date somebody. It's important for parents who are trying to figure out, maybe for the first time, you know what? My child is going to be entering into dating ages soon. I need to know what way am I going to deal with this? How hands on or hands off or hands in am I going to be with this process, if at all? They want to know this stuff. So I'm glad that the discussion's going on. I'm really also glad that people are finally feel free from a system that, even if courtship works for a whole lot of other people out there, or maybe some certain subgroups of people, that for all the people that it has not worked at all or has left some pretty deep scars, that this will be a refreshing approach if approached in the power of the Spirit and with a biblical mindset and everything. I'm eager to see how the culture and how the church appropriates these ideas and tries to weave them into their own communities. So it's encouraging to see the book, and that's why I had you on the podcast. Thank you so much, Thomas, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. You can get our podcast on iTunes or the Covenant Eyes blog at covenanteyes.com/blog. Be sure to leave a comment or a review and let us know your thoughts on this. What do you like about traditional dating? What do you dislike about it? Where do you think it has the potential to go wrong? Where do you see it possibly being a help to people? Let us know your thoughts in the comments or in the podcast reviews. Also, be sure to tell us what you want us to cover in future programs. Until next week, this is your host, Luke Gilkerson, signing off.